Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the Q&A session, if you'd like to ask a question, you may press star one on your phone. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn the call over to Mr. John Bateman. Sir, you may begin.
Good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email at nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. That's nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded at, and I'll spell it, https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/the word briefings, plural. With that, I will introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Deke Arndt, Chief of the Monitoring Section of NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the July U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the Drought Monitor. Our second presenter is Rick Toman, Climate Specialist with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He will provide an overview of the ongoing heat and its impacts in Alaska during July. And our third presenter is Brad Pugh, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the next 3 months. Our first speaker will be Deke from NOAA.
Thank you. And I will start on slide two, Global Climate, July 2019. The July was the warmest July on record, at 0.95 degrees Celsius or 1.71 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the 20th century average for July. Because July is also the warmest year or the warmest month on the calendar typically, this is also the warmest month on record for the global temperature. Looking separately at the land and ocean values, the land was second warmest to July of 2017 at 2.21 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the average for July. The ocean was the warmest on record for July at about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. It's not just the warmest July departure from average. It's the sixth largest departure from average for any month on record. And the 10 largest of these monthly anomalies have all occurred since September of 2015. This is the 43rd July and the 415th consecutive month that was warmer than its 20th century average. Going around the globe, the two maps show on the left, these are two lenses of looking at the same data. On the left, it shows how much warmer or cooler a place was than its 1981 to 2010 recent 30-year average. And on the right, it shows how a July temperature outcome compared to a place's long-term record. So the spots in red on the map on the right saw their warmest July on record. The places in the middle pink category saw a July that was much warmer than average or in the top 10% of July. As you can see, much of the Indian Ocean, southern Africa, big parts of the Pacific, and bits and pieces of Alaska, the Atlantic, and Central America had their warmest July on record. Africa as a continent recorded its warmest July on record. That's a record that dates back to 1910. And areas of interest more directly here to the United States, the Gulf of Mexico and the Hawaiian region each saw their second warmest July on record. Within the month, it was a warm month generally speaking, but within the month, heat waves in Europe, particularly towards the end of July, set many national records, so daily temperatures that were the warmest values observed in their nation. A selection of those countries are France, Belgium, Germany, Netherlands, Luxembourg, the UK, and Norway tied such a record. And then a station in Sweden set a record, appears to be a record for the highest temperature observed north of the Arctic Circle at 94.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Finally, not shown on this graphic, but the global sea ice extent, that both the northern hemisphere sea ice extent and the southern hemisphere sea ice extent were the smallest on record for July. The northern hemisphere, the Arctic sea ice, is in the middle of the melt season. The Antarctic sea ice is in the middle of the growth season. Both of those have the smallest on record. The combined area of the missing ice relative to the 1981 to 2010 average was almost exactly 1 million square miles. If this were a country, that area would be the 10th largest country in the world between Kazakhstan and Algeria. We'll move to the next slide, that's slide number three. This is what we call our horse race graphic. So this shows the global temperature as it evolves during the course of the year. That's 2019 in black. And we are seeing basically a picture of where it stands versus the warmest years on record in kind of a lap by lap, considering these 12 months, a 12-lap race. We are now pulling even with 2017 as the second warmest year to date on record through July. The warmest June and the warmest July on record globally have kind of helped pull us up to even with July 2017, with 2016 being the warmest year on record. There is virtually certain that we will have a top five warmest year on record. It's most likely to fall somewhere between second and fourth warmest by the time the analysis is done at the end of the year. Second, the rank of second is slightly more probable than the rank of third, which is slightly more probable than the rank of fourth. Moving on to slide number four, looking at what went on in the U.S., it was a warm July. We characterize it as warmer than average, which means it is in the top third of July's on record. The average temperature was 74.6 degrees Fahrenheit. This is about a degree Fahrenheit warmer than the 20th century average. You can see on the map the regions that were most warm relative to their July histories were much of the eastern United States, particularly along the Atlantic coast, and the Four Corners region. It was cooler in the plains and into the southern plains and into the northern Rockies as well. Alaska had its warmest July and month on record. Rick Toman's going to describe in detail the conditions in Alaska here very soon. The minimum temperatures, so the morning time temperatures relative to the long-term average, were again warmer, relatively speaking, than the afternoon temperatures. That's been a phenomenon that we've seen fairly consistently for the last decade or so. And according to our estimate of the residential energy demand based on temperature, this was the 12th highest energy demand on record for July. Finally, just in a year-to-date, in a temperature sense, Florida is currently working on its warmest year-to-date. On the right, the precipitation map shows that there, unlike many of the recent months, July did not have very large shields of anomalously high precipitation, but it did have several areas that were fairly wet. They were in the northern plains and upper Midwest, and then in the lower Mississippi Valley. It is common in summer for large-scale precipitation patterns to not be present, and events are more localized. There was very localized heavy precipitation in many places. Notably, the District of Columbia saw significant flooding. They got nearly a July's worth of amount of rain in an hour. That's according to our colleagues at the Northeast Regional Climate Center. And then Hurricane Barry made landfall in Louisiana and dropped a great deal of rain. Its rainfall footprint wasn't very large, but it was a slow-moving storm and dropped up to nearly 2 feet of rain in parts of Louisiana. And Arkansas saw its highest value of rain at a station due to a tropical cyclone. At Dierks, Arkansas, 16.59 inches of rain. That's according to our colleagues in the National Weather Service. We are still working on the wettest year-to-date, January through July, on record nationally speaking, despite the fact that July was a near normal and kind of, frankly, a little on the dry side of our normal category. We are still seeing the wettest year-to-date nationally. We saw the wettest August through July period on record, and we are now the months of August through July are the second wettest 12-month period. It's the first time in several months that we haven't broken that record. Moving on to slide number five, the current U.S. drought. We now have 6% of the contiguous U.S. in drought. That's roughly double what we saw in late June. The bump up this week, particularly in the southern plains and parts of the Midwest and Southeast, was 2%. That's actually a fairly significant jump up, but the overall footprint of drought in the U.S. is fairly small. There was some drought introduced in Iowa and Illinois, and according to our colleagues at the Midwest Regional Climate Center, this is the first drought in their region in more than about 30 weeks. I think I'm handing it off to Rick Toman now. He's going to speak about what's going on in Alaska.
Okay, thanks very much, Deke. So we're on slide six now, and July was really a remarkable month climate-wise in Alaska, and it's just the latest installment in what's been a really remarkable year. Extremely warm temperatures observed across the state from the tundra of the North Slope to the temperate rainforests of Southeast. And analysis by NCEI did rank this as easily the warmest July, and that makes it the warmest month of record. And as Deke mentioned, as the graphic shows, daily low temperatures were highest ranked since 1925 over a very large area, much larger than the maximum temperatures were ranked. And that's due in significant part to comparatively high humidities observed across much of Alaska during July. At the community level, from Utqiagvik in the north to Yakutat on the south coast, warmest month of records. A number of places in southern Alaska recorded their all-time warmest temperatures around the week of July 4th, including the first ever 90 degrees at Anchorage. And again, it's important to note that all of this follows this very warm June and a record warm spring in Alaska. At the end of July, a quarter of Alaska was rated in at least moderate drought, including much of Southeast, the Anchorage area, parts of the interior. And we have had rain in August to northern and western areas. These dry conditions have contributed to a very active wildfire season. So far, more than 3,800 square miles in Alaska has burned since May. That's about twice the area of Delaware. And while there have been much larger areas burned in recent years, this is just another instance in this increasing frequency of big fire years in the past few decades. With so much land burning, not surprising, smoke's been a big problem. Fairbanks, significant smoke on at least part of 25 days. Anchorage has had by far their smokiest summer of record, and it's not like the flames were nearby. Nearly all of the smoke in Anchorage was coming from the Swan Lake fire, which was on the Kenai Peninsula, 40 miles south of the city. On slide seven, take a look at the oceans. And, you know, really Alaska is one great big peninsula surrounded on three sides by oceans. And, in fact, about a quarter of Alaska's land is within 25 miles of saltwater. So it's no surprise that what happens in the Pacific and the Arctic Oceans has a profound effect on our weather and climate. And as you can see on the graphic, our oceans are hot. Based on NOAA's State of the Science Extended Reconstruction Sea Surface Temperature Database, the average temperature in both the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea east of the dateline for June and July were the highest in the past 125 years. That's correct. It's slightly warmer in the Gulf of Alaska than even during the blob years of 2014 to 16. North of the Bering Strait, open ocean temperatures in parts of the Chukchi Sea have regularly been 4 to 8 degrees Celsius, 7 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term average. In northern and western Alaska oceans, these very warm temperatures, in part fueled by the very early loss of sea ice, which started with the collapse of Bering sea ice in February and has continued unabated. Chukchi Sea has been at record low sea ice extent almost every day since mid-May. And as of right now, there is no sea ice at all within 125 miles of the Alaska coast. On slide eight, so why does this matter at all? Well, of course, these extremes have immediate impacts on Alaska, and these will continue into the future. In southeast Alaska, due to the ongoing drought, hydropower production has been reduced or eliminated at most southern panhandle communities, and that's forcing generation on much more expensive diesel. More than $150 million has been spent so far on wildfire protection and suppression, and of course, concerns with all that smoke from the fine particulates in wildfire smoke. Impacts to the ecosystem often take a long time to properly attribute, but in western Alaska during the spring and early summer, we've had many reports of washed up birds, seals, walrus that appear to have been malnourished. All across the state, there's been many reports of dead non-spawn salmon, in some places in significant numbers, and these have been associated with very warm river temperatures, in some cases measured temperatures approaching 70 degrees. And of course, bugs have thrived in the warm weather. We've had the significant damage reports to parts of the forest of southeast Alaska from hemlock sawfly, and spruce bark beetles have damaged additional acreage in south central. But all this is going to continue to impact our weather and climate in Alaska. Water being much denser than air, it takes a long time to warm up, and then it takes a long time to cool down. At this point, we can be certain that these warmer-than-normal ocean temperatures are going to continue through the autumn, in that in northern and western areas, sea ice formation is going to be much later than the long-term normal, and that will impact our weather and climate here in Alaska at least into the winter and probably beyond. So with that, I'll pass it off to Brad.
All right. Thank you, Rick. Moving to slide 9, which is the update on ENSO. In the upper left-hand corner, we have average sea surface temperature anomalies from July 14th through August 10th. And during that time period, above normal sea surface temperatures continue to persist in the central equatorial Pacific. But recently, below normal sea surface temperatures have developed in the eastern equatorial Pacific. North of the equator, above normal sea surface temperatures are currently present across the East Pacific. And given the current state of the ocean, but just as important, the atmosphere, that those two factors reflect a transition to ENSO neutral conditions recently. And in the lower right-hand corner there are the forecasts for either La Nina neutral or El Nino going forward season by season. And you can see in the gray there, the neutral category is probable through the winter of 2019-2020. The probabilities are fairly low, just slightly above 50% as you move into the winter season. So uncertainty is fairly high on the evolution of ENSO during the next several months, and La Nina is the least likely outcome during the next several months. And next slide, number 10. The September outlook for temperature calls for increased chances for above normal temperatures throughout much of the continental U.S., although there is a small area favoring below normal temperatures in the northern plains. Highest probabilities for the U.S. are for above normal temperatures across Alaska. And September precipitation outlook calls for increased chance for above-normal precipitation throughout the northern and central plains and also the northern and central Rockies. Above-normal precipitations also favored for much of Alaska. And this September outlook will be updated at the end of August. And next slide, number 11, the seasonal forecast for September, October, November. Favoring above normal temperatures throughout the U.S., but probabilities do vary by region. The highest probabilities for those above normal temperatures are forecasts for the Southwest, parts of the Northeast and Alaska. And you can see the lowest probabilities for above normal temperatures are forecasts for the northern Great Plains due to the expectation of ENSO neutral conditions, which could drive a little more of a variable temperature pattern this fall into the winter seasons. And on the right, the seasonal precipitation outlook calls for a slight tilt in the odds for above normal precipitation extending from the northern Great Plains southwest into the desert southwest. Above normal precipitation also favored from the Florida Peninsula north to the mid-Atlantic, and above normal precipitation also favored for Alaska. And finally, slide 12, the seasonal drought outlook. As Deke mentioned earlier, relatively small coverage of ongoing drought. There has been some short-term drought that's recently developed in the Corn Belt. That could persist or even expand slightly over the next few weeks. But by the end of this seasonal time period, the end of November, we're expecting the Corn Belt to be drought-free. Also, the small drought area in North Dakota, that should be eliminated. Kind of a mixed bag across the southern tier of the U.S. Most likely area for drought relief would be the parts of the southeastern U.S. where the drought is more short-term. Persistence and slight expansion is forecast for the southern plains. And persistence is also forecast for the Pacific Northwest, but as we move later into October and November, some limited drought relief would be expected for those areas. Elsewhere, drought improvement or removal is most likely for Alaska, also Hawaii, and drought is forecast to persist in Puerto Rico. So I'll turn it back to John now.
All right. Thanks so much, Brad. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question if possible. And operator, please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then you can queue up the first question.
Sure. At this time, we will begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. One moment for the first question. The first question in the queue is from Paul Rogers with San Jose Mercury News. Your line is now open.
Oh, hi. This is a question for Deke. This must be in the report. I just haven't seen it yet. What is the actual average global land and sea temperature, if it is the highest month ever recorded? What is that value? I assume it's like 59 or 60. I just wasn't seeing it. And then second, what role is climate change playing in these data today?
Hi, thank you for your question. I will drop offline and look up the actual temperature. It is available in our report. Hopefully, we can dredge it up here. But climate change is definitely the reason that we are very near the record. So if you think about kind of climate change as long-term being on an escalator, kind of riding it up over time, and climate variability, these phenomena like El Nino, La Nina that Brad spoke about, representing kind of jumping up and down while you're on that escalator, the combination of those results in a pattern that looks like a long-term trip up with some wiggles along the way. So the fact that we're in the neighborhood, that we're able to be kind of close to be setting records, that we're in the vicinity of the record warmest July, that's almost entirely due to climate change. The individual month-to-month, season-to-season outcomes are typically what make the difference in a record month or a near record month. So does that? I hope that makes sense. And then thank you very much. The overall temperature for July for the globe, we estimate it to be 62.13 degrees Fahrenheit or 16.74 degrees Celsius.
Finally, just to clarify, thank you, on something you said that you were saying it was near the record, but I noticed the report says with July 2019, the warmest July on record, at least nominally, this resulted in the warmest month on record for the globe. I guess the question is, was it or wasn't it the warmest month?
According to our data, at least nominally, yes, it was the warmest month. So there's three things happening to create the warmest month on record. One, July is typically the warmest month on the calendar, and that's because the northern hemisphere, which has a lot of land and shallow water, gets very warm during its summer, warmer than the southern hemisphere, which doesn't have much land and has a lot more deep water, gets during its summer. So July, just typically speaking on the calendar in any given year, is almost always the warmest month on that calendar. If you add to that the fact that the globe's been warming for many decades, that pushes us into a situation where we're typically in the vicinity of the warmest months on record. And then the fact that climate variability, things happened around the globe to make this July particularly warm, even just in the context of recent years, that pushed us over the top and resulted, and those three things together resulted in the warmest month on record that we've been keeping since 1880.
Thank you.
Next question is from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News. Your line is now open.
Thanks. Just a real quick question. The oceans were the warmest on record. Aside from the fading El Nino there, what were some of the other drivers that got the oceans so warm?
Hi, this is Deke, and the fact that the El Nino has been around, we had a modest El Nino for several months in 2019, and the effects of an El Nino that kind of recently expired, that there tends to be a little bit of a lag of a few months where this very large ocean heat pattern, kind of its signal can kind of live on in the global temperature to help keep ocean temperatures and temperatures around the globe a little elevated. El Nino, when it's present, basically acts like a heating pad beneath the atmosphere over a big chunk of the Pacific. And when that heating, and it has, you know, it's kind of that heating pad is kind of cooling down, but the lingering effects and kind of the buildup of its effects over recent months kind of help keep the ocean temperatures up. It's largely, of all of the known kind of modes of climate variability, it is the largest and biggest and has the most influence on a season-to-season basis. We've also seen the Indian Ocean. There are similar oscillation patterns in the Indian Ocean, the Indian Ocean Dipole, for one, that can play a role in elevating the temperature of the Indian Ocean. But if I had to pin myself down, I would say that it's the lingering effects of the recently expired modest El Nino that are the biggest among many factors.
Thanks.
The next question is from Rebecca Beach from The Hill. Your line is now open.
Yeah, hi. This question is for Deke. You briefly mentioned a statistic about this being the 12th most energy generation. I was wondering if you could repeat that statistic and then go a little bit more in depth about some of the factors.
Hi, yes. So one of our products that we run each month is called the Residential Energy Demand Temperature Index, the REDTI, and it's based on population distribution and heating and cooling degree days. That's a measure of that's a proxy for energy demand. So what this product tries to do is models the demand for electricity based solely on the population patterns that exist today and the temperature patterns that we see. Then assuming that today's population distribution goes back in time, we run that back to 1895 and determined that the energy demand in July of 2019 in the U.S. Would have been the 12th highest of the 120-something years on record. So it's basically a looking at the patterns on the map of where the most heating and cooling demand would be. So for July, obviously, cooling is going to drive the temperature. So it happened to be quite warm along the Atlantic coast where a lot of people live, and that elevates the demand for energy in residences. That help?
Thank you. Operator, do you have another question?
Yes, the next question in the queue is from Brian Kahn with Gizmodo. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks. I actually have a couple questions. One is for Deke and one is for Rick. So for Deke, I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit more about that Arctic Circle record that you mentioned briefly in terms of where it was set and what it will take to kind of verify that data out. And then for Rick, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the heat in the ocean around Alaska. I mean, if there has been any sort of study as far as, like, what's driving these particular, like, this current heat wave, or if that's still kind of going to be an area that's TBD research in the future.
This is Rick. I'll go ahead and go first. So the heat around Alaska, a couple of different factors in the Gulf of Alaska. A lot of that warmth is being driven by the atmosphere. Strong high pressure aloft has dominated for months now. That's why it's been so exceptionally warm, especially in southern Alaska. This was working on the Gulf of Alaska was already warmer than normal going into the warm season. So the atmosphere is probably playing a large role in that. We are seeing now that excess warmth is starting to work its way down, mix into the upper layers of the ocean. So while the fall storm season will soon be gearing up, the reason to think that that will persist for a while. In the Bering Sea and north of the Bering Strait, a lot of the warmth is being driven by the extremely early sea ice loss. With some places, the sun going to heat the water directly instead of going to melt ice as 6 weeks to 2 months longer than the historical average. So that's driving a lot of the really remarkable warmth across western and northwest Alaska.
Hi, this is Deke. I want to thank Rick for jumping in there while scrambled to come up with the factoid. So the location was named Marcus Vinsa, MarkusVinsa, Sweden. It was on July 26th. It recorded an afternoon temperature of 34.8 degrees Celsius, which is 94.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And according to the Swedish Meteorological Service, they established that as the highest temperature on record north of the Arctic Circle.
Next question in the queue is from Cecilia Smith with the U.S. News and World Report. Your line is now open.
Hi, my question was actually already answered. Thank you, though.
Next question is from John Boyer with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. This question is for Brad, looking at the September through November seasonal forecast. Can you talk about the factors leading us to higher odds of a wetter, warmer autumn in the mid-Atlantic? To what extent is tropical activity possibly involved? And are warmer ocean temperatures in the western Atlantic and Gulf figuring into that temperature outlook, or is it something more related to circulation?
Yeah, hi, this is Brad. Yeah, the temperature outlook for the mid-Atlantic northeast, that's mostly based on long-term trends. And the precipitation outlook calling for increased chances for precipitation
although the probabilities are still fairly tempered. It's also related to long-term trends. There's a wet trend across the Mid-Atlantic during the fall season. It is consistent with our updated hurricane outlook that came out recently, but no means implies a landfalling tropical system in the Mid-Atlantic.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yep. You're welcome.
The next question in the queue is from Tara Law with Time Magazine. Your line is now open.
Hi, I was hoping you could comment on how the high temperatures and global warming in general have contributed to wildfires, including in Siberia.
Hello, this is Deke, and I'm sorry, so globally speaking, we don't haven't made the direct connection to these events. It does not mean that the high temperatures were not related. We just haven't looked into that. I might defer to Rick if he has some perspective in Alaska.
Hi, this is Rick Tolman. In the subarctic, in the boreal forest, temperatures are really important. You would not expect, for instance, to get a big wildfire season when temperatures are below normal. So while high, unusually warm temperatures don't guarantee that there'll be big fires, you need ignition sources as well. Most of the big fires, at least in North America, are lightning starts. And so if you need to get both of those. You need to get it warm. Dry helps, and then some source of ignition, which is often, at least in North America, is lightning.
And I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Well, if there are no further questions, I will wrap up the call. First, I'd like to thank all of our speakers, for their time, and to everyone else for participating in the conference call. I will end by reminding you to mark your calendar for some upcoming releases. First, the August release of the U.S. Climate Highlights will be on September 6th, and the August release of the Global Climate Highlights will be on September 18th. Finally, any audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov Media Advisory site today. If you have any further informational needs, please email us again at nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. This concludes today's call. Thank you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please stand by.